Welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're going weird. Award-winningly weird. Zinnie Rocklin is the author of Flowers for the Sea, a weird horror novella that came out last year and just won a big old accolade. I'm pleased to say I already had her scheduled for the show, so I can't be accused of jumping on bandwagons. I already thought the book was good. Flowers for the Sea is a truly weird, with a capital W, story, but it's also weirdly pertinent in light of events since its release. It's a story about eco-crisis, enforced motherhood and inequality. Go figure. As well as those main themes, Zin and I also discuss pain and all its uses. We explore racial bias in fiction, including my own. We talk about representing bodies in story, including the underused sense of smell. And to keep it light, there's also a last-minute nod to obscure British sitcom Keeping Up Appearances. That was weird. So come with me down to the shore, where a boat awaits. The lower decks are already slick with blood. Let's talk scared. Well, hi, Zin, and welcome to Talking Scared. How are you doing?
Hi, thank you for having me. This is incredible. I'm very excited.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear. It's actually great to have you on the show. The listeners are kind of used to me speaking to authors who have got a brand new book out to promote, and that isn't the case in your case. A few weeks ago, people may have seen on Twitter that I put out this call for more diverse voices for 2023 because I looked at my list of guests this year and I was like, wow, that is a white set of people. And you were one of the first writers to message me, so I had you on this list. And then when we had a cancellation, or when I cancelled an interview recently, it was a great chance to kind of pump you up that list right away and get you on the show. So yeah, it also helps, as I said to you off air, that your last book is a novella. So when it came to getting you right up on that schedule, I didn't have to kill myself by fitting in an extra 400 pager at the last minute. So
yeah,
it's all worked out pretty well. That novella in question is called Flowers for the Sea. And though it may be less than 100 pages long, it certainly isn't short of talking points. It's very, very weird with a capital W.
And I
should take the chance now to say congratulations, because just a few days ago at this year's Necronomicon, I believe it was one of the winners of the very first Joseph S. Pulver Award for Weird Fiction.
Yes, thank you very much. That came as a complete shock. I'm still kind of reeling, to be honest.
Well, you were there in person, right, to receive the award?
Yes, I was.
Did you know you'd been nominated, or is it just kind of picked out of a hat randomly?
It was a complete shock.
So you're sat there at the dinner, I presume, and all of a sudden you just hear your name.
Yeah, basically, it was like they handed out two awards for basically for longstanding service within the community. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. This is awesome. And to be frank, I was a little tipsy. So feeling nice, kind of like really enjoying seeing old friends and, you know, and it's a pretty good DJ. And you're just relaxed and having fun and seeing people for the first time in 3 years and meeting people that you've only known online and things like that. And then all of a sudden, like, they're talking about the Joseph S. Pulver Award for those in Weird and blah, blah, blah. And Craig Gidney was called first. And I was like, that's awesome. That's so cool. That's so dope. Craig is another person you should definitely have the guest have on your list. His book, Spectral Hue, is incredible.
Cool.
Yeah, so Craig goes up. Craig was like looking around like, wait a minute, what, me? So he went up and got his award. And then S.J. Bagley was like, oh, so there we have a second award. And this person is this. And I was half listening, to be honest, because like I'm hanging out with Cassandra Call. Like, And they and I are just like, you know, just kind of hanging out. And then I hear SJ say, "So where's Terry Clark?" which is my government name. And I was like, "Wait a minute, what? Me?" And they were like, "Yeah, writing as Zin E. Rockland." I said, "No way." It took a solid minute for me to walk up to the podium because I was just like, "No way, this is not real." And everyone was laughing because it was just like, yeah, Zin, you're getting an award.
Well, awesome. I mean, having read the book and having kind of my mind blown and my stomach churned by it, I can see why it won. But yeah, massive congrats.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, let's get to the book in question, shall we? Because it's suddenly topical because it's award winning. So this is just the most perfect timing. Flowers for the Sea came out last year. So to whatever degree you see fit, tell us about this weird world that you've conjured.
Okay, so my elevator pitch is that it's a pregnant woman trapped on a boat with the last of humanity. And she believes that her baby is not human. Basically, we follow Aroxy as it's a first-person narrative, and she is angry. That is what you get right off the bat. She is an angry, angry character. As the book goes along there, you understand a little bit more. Hopefully, you understand a little bit more of her anger and why she is so angry. And it is about Aroxy as well as the restraints of limited thinking. So this is a family that communes with the ocean, that understands the ocean like no other land dweller. And the village shuns them. So there is a lot of conflict there. Aroxy is feeling very rejected while being used. And she tries to morph that into a power of her own. Yeah, so that's kind of a wrap up of it.
And I'll just add to that, there are also, like, you know, weird creatures and killer kind of birds, the fish bird things that come along and all of that stuff. But yeah, it is very much a kind of interior story in many ways about Aroxy, isn't it, I suppose?
Yes.
With the trappings of weird fiction and science fiction around it. Can we start with a few contextualizing questions?
Sure.
I'll explain why. There are some books that I read, and because I have to read books pretty quickly for this show, because I don't have the time, quite often I come to these conversations, perhaps not with the fullest understanding that I would have if I'd taken my time and, you know, really pored over the words and thought about all the meaning. So basically, sometimes I come to these conversations going, please explain your book to me. But there's just a few questions I have. And I think the ambiguity is one of the strengths of the novella, just to make that clear. Mm-hmm. In terms of setting and period, right, mm-hmm. you could easily read this as a piece of sort of second world fantasy, mm-hmm. or you could read it as a post-apocalypse, or, and this is what I chose to do, although I think I'm probably wrong, you could read it as sort of ancient history, because there's one reference to the sirens of Greek myth that it got me thinking, I wonder if this is, you know, Zin's version of the Atlantean sort of crisis, because it's all about how this world is flooded and they have to take to the ocean. You know, it could be an Atlantis myth. How do you see it? Is it our world? Is it a different world? Does it even matter?
In order for me to write it, I definitely thought it was second world, but also ancient. So you're not entirely wrong. But I also, when I was talking with my editor about it, it kind of felt like it didn't matter to be that specific. I wanted the reader to kind of run away with it and see where their imagination allowed them to end up. And I had a lot of folk tell me that it was second world, which isn't wrong. I don't see it wrong as far as it being our world that has gone post-apocalyptic. I think it's open for interpretation in that particular case. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you say, like, you know, it doesn't really matter, that's kind of what I thought, really, because in many ways, it's a kind of allegorical tale, isn't it? Kind of almost a sort of semi-metaphor for certain things that were, it's just kind of human condition thing as opposed to really it mattering whether it's our world or another one.
Yeah.
Well, this is the more serious question.
Okay.
I kind of want to caveat this with a sort of semi-apology because there's a chance I may be being completely fucking ignorant here. So forgive me if I am. The race of your characters, or put it a different way, the ethnicity, I should say, of your characters. Iraxi is black.
Yes.
What about the others aboard? Because I couldn't work out whether Iraxi's ostracization is partly because of her skin color or just because of her social class.
It was mostly focused on social class. There are virtually no white characters actually in the book. I wanted to touch on it a little bit, but not focus too much on it. But as far as the infighting that can be created by colonialism, such as colorism, there were like some small clues as far as that, such as talking about how Ket wore her femininity a little bit different or more in a more acceptable way than Iraxi, because Iraxi's dark skin, she's a larger woman and things like that. So it was not something that most of the characters were of color, not necessarily just black, but I wanted to keep that kind of ambiguous as well because of our own default biases when we walk into a lot of reading.
That's why I kind of asked the question with a bit of apology, because it's something that I think about a lot and I've spoken about a lot with authors like Tanana Reeve-Du and Zakiya Dalila Harris. You know, as you said, the default bias that when we read a book, quite often we read the book with the assumption that unless someone specifies their ethnicity in a book, they are white. So I then felt kind of awkward, sort of implying that I was confused by your characters, because it's kind of implying that you should have to specify that your characters are black. Do you know what I mean?
And yeah,
it's the, sort of the inverse of that bias almost.
Right. And I wanted to, it was a little bit of a challenge for my readers. I wanted to challenge them to think about their biases. Like, and that's something that I tend to write in my fiction in general. Like I have the story called The Night Sun.
About the werewolves, great story.
The werewolves, yes. Where I had read part of it aloud at a reading, and I had an audience member come up to me and say, I initially thought that the husband was black. And you know, you're giving me a reason to kind of check my own biases as well. It's definitely something that I like to challenge readers with.
Yeah, and it certainly got me thinking about the way I interpret books, because so you've got a book that takes a lot of characters of color, puts them on a boat on the ocean. They're suffering. They're malnourished. There's all kinds of privation. I couldn't help but sort of impose some haunting of things like, you know, obviously like the Middle Passage, the Atlantic slave trade, things like that. And that seemed to me an obvious kind of thing at the back of all this. But then I started thinking, I'm quite loath to just impose a racial reading on a book simply because it's written by a writer of colour, if that makes sense. Was any of that imagery to do with things like that? Or is that my imposition?
To be honest, yeah, that's your imposition, but it's an interesting imposition because you're not alone in it. I wanted to, in this particular case, the Middle Passage did not play a factor in how I set up the boat. I wanted it to be that these are seafaring folk in the sense of they build for the sake of luxury as well as for practicality. So this is a boat. This is essentially like an old school cruise, I guess you could say. okay. that fell in disrepair because obviously it can't dock and be maintained. That's something that I subconsciously end up challenging my readers with as well, as far as kind of contextualizing the suffering of Black folk towards mm-hmm. colonialism and colonialist history. I want to recontextualize it in the sense of building worlds that don't have that baggage.
Yes. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, sadly, the baggage this world does have, which is analogous with our own, is this kind of, I suppose, climate crisis, or at least an ecological crisis, that the oceans have risen, they flooded the land, and people are taken to the sea. And it's quite interesting, actually, because I've been reading two books at the same time, yours and Hayley Piper's No Gods for Drowning.
Oh, I can't wait to get that. Mm.
That's for an episode coming soon, I think, in 2 weeks. And that's also this really dark second world fantasy about the sea reclaiming the land with these things in the ocean that pose a threat. And the similarities are quite striking, even though they're very different books. And I wonder if this is the start of the great eco-horror trend that I've been predicting for a while.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I started it 5 years ago now. And it was a combination of my fear of the ocean, my respect and fear of the ocean, mm-hmm. And the very crappy reality. Sorry, I'm trying not to curse.
Curse all you want, it's fine.
Oh, sweet. The shitty reality of our world reclaiming itself, mm-hmm. Because that's what's really going on. We are the species to get rid of. This is a mass extinction event. So the Earth is going to be fine. It's us who are fucked.
I always love when people talk about the end of the world, and they don't really mean that. They mean right. the end of humanity. Yeah.
Right. It's the end of humanity. It is not the end of the world. This reclamation is frightening.
Mm-hmm.
You
kind of allude to it in fragments and memory, and you know, a lot of this is quite expressionistic mm-hmm. in this book. But there's one bit that really I've been interested by, and I've been thinking about this since I read it on a broader scale than just your book. It's got me thinking about something. And it could be that it's completely erroneous and that I'm just seeing things that aren't there. But there is, when Iraxi is describing what went wrong, mm-hmm. there's a passage where she describes how the fish died, how the summers got longer and hotter, and how, you know, Iraxi and her family and her people were blamed. And to quote briefly, she says, "We were accused of wild atrocities against their nature, copulation with sea creatures, conjuring stones with a snap of a finger, death to their industry with a sigh." So there's that sense of like old school kind of like witch hunt stuff there.
Yeah.
But there's one brief word choice in there that fascinated me. That phrase, wild atrocities against their nature. Mm-hmm. And nature can mean a couple of things. There's nature in terms of like their customs and their behaviour. But there's also this idea that the natural world belongs to the powerful.
Yes.
You know, that the outsider, the refugee, the person in the developing world, that they are just bystanders, or even worse, to blame for this grand collapse, when in fact the opposite is largely true. Now, am I making far too much of one word choice there?
Absolutely. I am glad that you... That is fantastic. That is exactly what I was going for. That is exactly what I was going for. I mean, think about the whole plastic straw movement, where it's just like, no, you can't use plastic straws, but we have, you know, billionaires taking 14 minute mm-hmm. air flights to skip town. Like, you know, it's just as you're saying that the thoughts and habits of the powerful are never questioned enough.
Yeah, they're refugees without a destination. And I'm in Europe right now, you know, we've got the war in Ukraine, and we've got obviously mass climate migration starting to happen. And we treat it as if it's an assault on our way of life. Mm-hmm. We don't treat it as if it's desperate people who are reaping the ill rewards of technologized culture. We treat it as if people are coming over here and ruining our civilization, as if that's the thing that must be protected.
Right. It's this idea of what is civilized versus not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like I'm Trinidadian. My background is Trinidadian. I'm first generation American. And going to Trinidad and hanging out, or not hanging out, but being with family and stuff like that. And, you know, I remember times of things have definitely changed economically for the country and for my family. But, you know, there are times where you had to get a bucket for water, for tea, for your shower, for things like that. I remember rejoicing when running water would come through. And the way I would rejoice, it was like, people were like, wait, aren't you from America? Don't you have this all the time? I'm like, yeah, but at the same time, like I'm here. And this is bringing my family joy. This is bringing a moment of relief for them. So I'm happy for them as well. But like, even still going through bringing up your own bucket and things of that sort, it expands your definition of what is supposedly civilized. Mm-hmm. What should be part of the status quo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's definitely been an interesting look at how we are socially, and how we tend to look down our noses at a lot of differences.
Yeah, and there is a definite difference in the way that Iraxi is framed against, you know, people like Ketu is this, you know, she's the closest thing to a medical professional on board. Mm-hmm. There is, you can read, there is a sort of sneering attitude towards Iraxi from everyone else, even yes. though she is the one carrying the potential savior. And that actually brings us from one allegorical crisis to another, because Flowers for the Sea is about, in many ways, pregnancy and birth and motherhood. Mm-hmm. And it's about that at a time when those issues have once again become an open political battlefield. And there's a line really early in the book when Iraxi says, I've been told to the point of biliousness, this child must be born. Mm-hmm. And that reads very differently post the recent shit show with reproductive rights in America. I mean, how do you feel about the book now, considering what's happened in the last few months?
It worries me that there is this idea of, you know, well, if the child wasn't born, where would Iraxi be at this point? But at the same time, it's kind of like, that child was born, you were fucked. So, you know, you force this birth upon her, you force this motherhood upon her, and your world ended. Spoiler alert.
Well, yeah, but to be clear, because the position that Iraxi basically finds herself in is quite literally just I don't know what the word would be, just a host for something that other people value, but they don't value her at all,
right?
Do they?
Right.
And that's why she herself sees the child as a parasite, because it's more about the way that she's been made to feel, you know. But it's so striking that you know, you wrote this last year. Obviously, a lot of this stuff was already in the kind of the political zeitgeist, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in this year, it's come so much to the foreground how much, you know, the authorities in America see women as just secondary hosts to unborn fetuses. It's a really striking book. It's almost like you wrote it in response to that rather than beforehand.
Yeah, it's very strange how that happened. Like, it became, I started writing it 5 years ago, and it really started out really small as far as, it was really, the focus was about, I tend to write for therapy. So it was therapeutic and cathartic in the sense of getting out my respect, my healthy respect for the ocean, as well as my healthy respect for pregnant people and for people who decide to give birth, because there's nothing ordinary about this. Even under the most perfect circumstances, gestation and childbirth are just insane to me. But you put it under the pressure of the patriarchy and of this society that wants to dictate what is civilized. Because even having a child out of wedlock is still, you know, taboo and still looked at as mm-hmm. not right. To have a hysterectomy, you have to have the consent of the nearest male in your family. So for me, since I'm not married, it would be like my father would have to give me permission to get a hysterectomy.
I did not know that. That is horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely horrifying.
Sorry, I'm just a bit taken aback. I had no idea. My mother had a hysterectomy because after my birth, there were all kinds of complications. So mm-hmm. it's an issue that has some personal resonance for me, you know, because she would have died. But like, I had no idea you had to get sort of sign off. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, I know my mom had to get permission from my dad to get a tubal ligation when I was born. And it's, I believe that's changed, but as far as the hysterectomy, it has not changed. It's depressing to think about, but at the same time, it's like, you know, my anger calls into action. Uh-huh. And I have to express in some kind of way how incredibly callous all of this is. Because they ultimately don't care about the actual child. It's about the potential. It's all about potential. It's all about the possibility of something that statistically is just not going to happen. Whatever that thing may be, you know, the next Nobel Prize winner, the next, oh God, the next billionaire or something. Gross. But at the same time, like, there's this, it's all about potentiality, and it's destroying people.
I mean, you mentioned being angry, and I get the impression that, and catharsis as well. And it feels like you put that into this book because it's kind of unapologetically graphic when it comes to the physical realities of pregnancy and childbirth. I mean, I'm just being a kind of typical, like, cringing guy here, but the descriptions of how Irax is torn by the birth, they made me wince, you know. Mm-hmm. We guys are not good at dealing with that particular consequence. But you did seem very keen to make physicality and bodily issues like the core sensibility of your book, yet it never feels like body horror in the usual sense of that word. What are your thoughts?
I think pain is a commonality that runs through all of humanity. We do everything we can to alleviate pain, but it's also relative. My pain scale is very different to yours. Scientifically, it is considered most women have a lower threshold of pain tolerance, but it's wider, if that makes any sense, than men. I think we do a lot of things to avoid pain, except those of us who tend to, like, I battle depression. I battle several types of depression, as well as PTSD and general anxiety. And I used to be a cutter. And I have a lot of tattoos, things like that. And my mother, number one person, just doesn't understand why I put myself through pain. And I say it's to alleviate a different kind of pain.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways, we do things to avoid pain. We shop, we have sex, we drink. There are a lot of ways that people cope with pain in ways that isn't the obvious opposite. So in my case, it's not, I'm going through mental anguish. I need to feel the physical anguish. It's not something that's always so black and white. So I think in a lot of ways, confronting pain is something that forces the audience to pay more attention. And I had a lot of people complain about about the pain descriptions and things like that. Like, I had a lot of women, cis women, buck back against and lower their rating because of my quote unquote unnecessary descriptions. But at the same time, again, it's like these are things that people tend to want to forget, want to mm-hmm. avoid. With the pain of childbirth, there is literally a lapse in memory. A lot of women, a lot of birthing folk rather, don't remember the amount of pain that they were in, but they will admit that it's the most difficult thing they've ever done in their life, but they'll do it again and again and again and again. My grandmother did it 11 times. I don't understand at all. But I think pain is a commonality that brings an understanding more on a level that is much more visceral and much more tangible than a lot of other things.
I'm just making a mental link from your book to Hellraiser now.
I love Hellraiser so much. I love Clive Barker.
Yeah. Well, you know what? There is a link there between your writing and Clive Barker's. It's that sensory sort of overload in all its the different senses, because this book is a very sensory experience. Your book, rather, very sensory experience, because it's not just pain, is it? There is pleasure in there. There's an awful lot about, you know, touch. She's touching this fruit. She's peeling the fruit. It's very kind of rich in description. There's a whole thing about, you know, body odor, which is something that I realize you frankly just do not read about that often, because the fact that it struck me as such a powerful passage made me realize that that's the thing that really doesn't get mentioned much in fiction, like the odor of bodies. And I think that Clive does something very similar, that the kind of like the weird sort of like twisted erotics of the body, I suppose.
Because smell is actually, I believe I read this, that smell is the number one trigger for memory.
I've heard that, yeah.
So yeah. I think in a lot of people in polite society, we tend to not tell someone if they stink, but we might ask them if they put on deodorant. It's like, you know, our smell leads to so much. Smell could lead to a hookup, could lead to you feeling nauseated. So I think smell is definitely something that should be talked about a little bit more.
Speaking of bodies, I know that you have written very eloquently about your own in the past, particularly in an essay called My Genre Makes a Monster of Me. And for listeners, that was published in Uncanny Magazine's award-winning Disabled People Destroy Science Fiction issue, which I will stick in the show notes because everyone should read it. It's a very open, kind of exposed essay. And you kind of end it by talking about the weight and the importance of the work you set out to do. Now, without asking you to rehash your entire argument, can you elaborate a little bit on on why you wrote the essay and how that sense of responsibility and weight perhaps feeds into Flowers for the Sea?
I would say as far as the responsibility and weight, it started with the reason why I wanted to get to start publishing. The reason why I started writing really was because I wanted to see characters that look like me in situations that I found interesting. To be put it frankly, I wanted to see Black women in horror, and surviving horror, because we are an incredibly, we're survivalists at, especially Black Americans. We are, because that's the perspective that I can really write from. As Black American, as a Black American woman, I can't even think of words today. Sorry. we are ingrained. It's ingrained in us, rather, that we are strong, and strong on emotional levels that a lot of other cultures and backgrounds would not necessarily understand. I wrote the essay from a perspective of wanting to be held, to be frank. It was wanting to be held while recognizing the strength that it takes to ask to be held, from a background that is most commonly dismissed as too strong for anyone. You know, the whole "I'm an independent woman, I don't need no man" type of thing. But it ends up translating into, I don't need friends, I don't need community, I don't need a hug. And it's like, no, we need hugs, we need our hands held, we do desire the same things that the rest of humanity does as well. So that essay came from, just as you were saying, it is a very open essay. It's a very vulnerable essay in wanting to get that across, that we desire to be held in ways that we have not before. So my responsibility became getting about and interweaving that in my work, as far as showing the vulnerabilities, even through anger, even through being difficult, because as difficult as Aroxy is, she has this moment with both Amit as well as Herat where she wants to be touched. She wants to be vulnerable to them, but she doesn't trust them. She can't trust them. And all she's asking for in return is really to be claimed, to be acknowledged as someone that is worthy of love, is worthy of attention, is worthy of reverence. Mm-hmm. So it's something where I want that in my fiction. I used to write romance, and it was definitely a theme in my romance as well. So it's something that I bring over to science fiction, fantasy, and horror, for sure.
Right. Well, I completely understand the thing about wanting to be held and wanting to, you know, write Black female characters who can be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, not to contradict you about your own essay here, by the way, but just to ask, at the same time, there's another quote I want to read for this, from the essay this time rather than from the book. But I want to kind of see how it applies, because you kind of reminisce and you say that, quote, every story taught in school that featured a character with skin and hair like mine was a story of struggle and pain and abuse. So I donned the body of a mental gymnast, ignoring and replacing descriptive words in the likes of R.L. Stine, Douglas Clegg, Peter Straub, Stephen King, with those that mirrored mine. And so the Black woman could be the one who makes it to the end. So the way I took that is that, you know, when you read horror, as you said before, so often Black characters are contextualized within suffering, either the immediate in their lives or some kind of generational trauma of things that have come before, because they're being written by essentially white men, and that's the way that white men back then saw black characters. They probably even thought they were doing a good thing by being sympathetic, you know, but I get that it leaves no space for victory. So I wonder, as much as you're trying to make sure that Araxi can be vulnerable, she also is the person who endures, and she doesn't just make it to the end. She's someone with the power and the fury to bring everything crashing down. Mm-hmm. So how do you marry that with the vulnerability, if that makes sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. I think where I wrote that essay from was a little bit more of a hopeful place.
Okay.
I guess you could say. I wanted to believe that there was a life that did not have that generational trauma and that strife. But the truth is that it just does not exist amongst Black people. My mission from here is, sure, yes, there is suffering. Sure, there is generational trauma, and there is the impacted endurance. But instead of it having that main focus in the sense of things will forever be this way, I wanted to give it hope in a way that is about it's okay to start over. Mm-hmm. It's okay to acknowledge what happened in the past, and it's okay to start to move on from that. My mom has dementia, and this is a cruel, cruel disease. My mother and I do not get along very well. We never did. But I now live with them, and it's an adventure, you could say. And a lot of it is because she can't retain the present. She tends to go back to the past quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Some of it wistfully, a lot of it resentfully. You can feel the trauma that she has gone through because she also has her wits about her in the sense of, I don't know if you're familiar with the show Keeping Up Appearances.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
My mom is Hyacinth Bouquet. She is Bucket.
That is a very British reference.
Yes, yes, yes. My mom is Hyacinth, very much Hyacinth. So she looks at things in this kind of romanticizing it a little bit, or mm-hmm. smoothing it over as much as possible. But at the same time, the fact that she repeats these stories over and over again, and the way she tells it, you can tell that there is trauma there, that there is something that still bothers her about it. But she won't acknowledge it to the point that, yes, this bothered me. Yes, this traumatized me. Yes, this fucked me up, to be honest. So that she can start to move on from that. She won't do it. And that is like a petri dish for me to see just how fucked up generational trauma is and how it can keep us in this cycle. Because that's why she and I don't get along. Like, my father tries to make her vulnerable in some ways, tries to ask her vulnerable questions to get her to expose that wound so that it can start to heal. Because as you know, you can't heal a wound without air. There's only so long that it can stay covered. So he tries to talk her through things and things like that, but she'll immediately understand what's going on and shut it down because she can feel herself becoming vulnerable. I want to build characters who have that innate desire, that mustard seed desire of wanting to be vulnerable, and for them to find a safe space to do so. Whether it's through birthing a demon who helps you take over the world, or through simply finding a found family, such as with the Night Sun. So yeah, I think it's hella important to find that balance between the strong persona that we have to put on versus the vulnerability that we have, that we hide away.
Well, that's a hell of a mission going forwards in your fiction. I always close these conversations by asking you to kind of reflect on someone else's fiction. Do you have a book that you would like to recommend to my listeners and a reason why?
We Are Here to Hurt Each Other by Paula D. Ash. Paula and I share a deep, deep love and borderline uncomfortable obsession with Clive Barker. And she has created this short story collection. It came out earlier this year, I believe. And there is a common thread of this creature in it, reminiscent of, if you want to put it through the comp machine, as far as, you know, publishing goes, as far as like Pinhead, in the sense of the Hellraiser series. But it's to see this mythos, this string through characters that are that black characters and characters of color is just incredible to see. It's such a good and haunting book.
Cool.
It's really, really good.
I love connected short stories, so yeah, that can go straight on the list. Mm-hmm. So that's to reiterate, Paula Ash, We Are Here to Hurt Each Other.
Yes.
Yeah, that's going straight on the list. Thank you very much. My last question's in is, what truly scares you?
What truly scares me is nothingness. Because there's always something that slithers underneath.
Oh.
There is never nothing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the dark holds secrets. The ocean holds secrets. No matter how deep you go, there's still something there. So there's this false sense of security with nothingness that scares the shit out of me.
Oh, a wonderful answer. That's properly existential.
Yes.
Yeah, that is pure weird fiction. Yeah. Zin, listen, I'm really glad I got to speak to you about Flowers for the Sea, because it's a complex book that I now have a kind of much better grasp of. It's been out for a while, and listeners can get their hands on it right away, and I hope they do. Massive congratulations again on the award, and thanks for talking scared.
Yes, thank you for having me. This is awesome.
That was one of those episodes that just became far more deep than I'd predicted. It feels like Zin is pouring a lot of her pain and anger and her personal circumstances into her stories, especially in Flowers for the Sea. And that helps make sense of a really complex book, actually. Like I said at the start, this may only be a slim volume, but it's dense and it's weighty, and I wish I'd had more time to read it slowly. The reading for this show has caught up with me recently in quite a big way, and I feel under pressure to read, but also quite guilty for not giving authors' books the time they really deserve. I'm doing my best. Anyway, all I kept thinking whilst reading and then editing this episode is how much Flowers for the Sea is reflecting the real world. In Zin's novella, the ecological crisis is a setup rather than a direct threat. But when you look at the horrendous floods in Pakistan right now, suddenly those scenes feel way more frightening, especially because those real floods are happening in a part of the world that is often considered lesser or of less importance by Western media. The inequality, then, in Zin's novella is shown in stark relief there. That's what I was talking about with this sense of Western dominion over the environment. Then we won't rehash the issues with reproductive rights, but let's just say that Flowers for the Sea manages to cram a lot of that political reality into its expressionistic, allegorical story. Some lines could be ripped directly from the headlines. And one thing I should have brought up, actually, is how the birth in Zin's novel is essential for her society's survival. And that creates this interesting juxtaposition to these bullshit claims about white survival that are behind so much of this pro-life rhetoric. That would have been something I'm sure Zin could have taken apart really thoughtfully. Next time, I'll ask her next time, because I do want to have her back on the show, especially to ask her why she's so afraid of the ocean. I kept not pulling on that thread. Yeah, great interview, great chat. Loved speaking to her. I must say that a really cool thing happened to me this week. I was walking to the Trafford Centre, which, for those who don't know, is a big shopping mall in Manchester, otherwise known as Hell on Earth or a place just waiting for zombies. Anyway, I'm walking along doing my bit for capitalism when I get a tap on the shoulder and a very nice, friendly person asks me if I have a podcast and is it called Talking Scared. Yep, folks, that's right. I was recognised. I was more than a little bit taken aback and lost for words. So, Hayley, if I seemed off or if I failed to ask you anything about yourself, as I typically do, my apologies. It was just so cool and so surreal that I just sort of staggered off with my wife excitedly proclaiming that I was famous. Yeah, she's very excited. So thanks very much. It had been a hard week. I was really tired. I didn't want to be there, and you re-inflamed my enthusiasm for making this show. Now, I don't ever expect to meet anyone else in the flesh, but I do nonetheless want to hear from you. You can reach me the usual way, email to talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or on Twitter and Insta at talkscaredpod. And I've had some wonderfully kind reviews this week too, so if you can leave one yourself, that would be marvellous. And many thanks to those who have. You can also support the show via Patreon and get loads of bonus content and extra episodes. Just click the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. All contributions are greatly appreciated. Okay, I'm off now. I'm back next week with Gemma and more, and something quite a bit different to my usual interview style. You'll see. Until then, know your worth, use your pain, and make the bastards who hurt you wish they were you. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.